Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us this edition of Leak Project. I'm your host, Rex Bear, and we have Clint Richardson with us from realityblog.wordpress.com. Also go to thecorporationnation.com. And we also have one other website that I'd recommend checking out, strawmanstory.info. Now, for anybody that's heard of the term straw man, I'm sure you guys have an idea on what these websites refer to as far as the overall concept. But as far as the different videos, documentaries, current events, and information that has been put together by Clint over the years, I'm telling you, just a ton of data. And Clint also did radio for several years, so he's had an opportunity to speak with people from all around the world as well. And we're going to get into a gourmet buffet of information here that isn't talked about oftentimes in the mainstream media. So, Clint, really appreciate you joining us here at the Leak Project. How the heck are you?
I thank you. There's so many people out there that seem to want to, especially in our movement, that seem to want to expose each other more so than exposing what's happening to us collectively. I was watching the interviews between Gore Vidal and the debates between Gore Vidal and William Buckley, which I highly recommend people do because it was kind of the beginning of the if you will, the right left sort of paradigm that we live in today, that sort of you always have to be on one side or the other, and there's never a middle ground. There's never an actual place where you can go to escape this sort of mentality of left versus right, you know, right versus wrong. And it turns out that both sides are wrong. And not so much wrong as it's just incomplete, right? Everybody's kind of got an incomplete story. So I thank you for having me, and I kind of always respected David Icke in his want to talk to whoever will listen. You know, he always talks about his I used to stand up in front of two people and give a 10-hour presentation, or I'd stand up in front of 10,000 and give a 10-hour presentation. Anyway, either way, it's kind of the same. You know, you want to reach as many people as you can, and especially today, it's become such a strange world, right?
Oh, it certainly is fascinating. We live in, I would call it, kind of a combination of Orwellian meets 1984 meets Twilight Zone meets X-Files meets Tron. It's incredible. You have a piece of the pie, like you said, that people go after each other oftentimes, and they don't really embrace each other. And you've got a piece of the pie that's very valuable. So talk to us about your story.
Well, you know, I'm kind of one of those sort of more unique stories, I think. It's just kind of always in the wrong place at the right time, depending on how you look at it. For instance, well, you know, I was at 17, I got cancer. And so that, of course, set me on a journey to, you know, what the hell is causing cancer in young people. My brother's youngest son got the same cancer when he was 1 year old and died at the age of 9. So that sort of put me into a different state of mind, I think, than most people, sort of what I call kind of a mortality complex. You know, like I decided I wasn't going to get married or have children because who knows how long I was going to be around, that sort of thing. I traveled. I tried to enjoy life as much as I could. But as I traveled around and saw all these different cultures, which, by the way, brought me to New York, New York City, Manhattan, I started realizing that what we call culture in America is really not culture at all. It's actually kind of it's more like an absence of culture. Tradition, that sort of thing, and it's you know, they call it a melting pot. So I'm in New York, living in this really great rent controlled situation, and directly between the World Trade Center and the Empire State Building, and you know, 9/11 comes along, and I'm watching it from my roof. And which was quite a unique experience, you know, being there and actually experiencing it firsthand, having people show up all covered in dust, wanting to use the shower and stuff. It was an interesting time, and that you know, again, was one of those kick in the pants as I'm watching the news, you know, speculate for the first little bit, and then all of a sudden they close and they have the same story everywhere you look. I was like, wait, what happened to everything else you were talking about? Now it's Osama bin Laden, Osama bin Laden, Osama bin Laden, who is of course saying, I didn't do this. What are you talking about? I'm not that stupid. I'm not going to put my people in jeopardy like that. Right. Combine that with, you know, just the shock of it all, the cell phones going out, the bridges closed. You're in a basically a martial law situation, soldiers with machine guns, you know, down in the subways. And, I just happened to live below 14th Street. So we had the street was closed. I had the missing persons center across the street from me, St. Vincent's Hospital, two blocks away, where people were giving blood to no avail. It was just a really wild, wild experience. But the wildest part was actually going, you know, in New York, you have basically a grocery store, big or small, on almost every block. And so going to the grocery store and seeing, first of all, the internet's out, so they couldn't take credit cards. So thank God we had cash. And then second of all, watching as the whole store has a line around it going, you know, all the way around the store and into one aisle, watching the water disappear, watching the food disappear. And by the time we get up, you know, there's nothing left in the store. And I don't think people can imagine what that actually feels like. I know we talk about it a lot. We say get prepared and we say this, but to experience it firsthand is quite different. And even though we didn't feel threatened, it was an experience again that kept pushing me forward to this sort of discovery aspect of things. I decided to settle down, because I was still alive and free of cancer. So I went to sound engineering school, became a sound designer in Hollywood. I worked on movies, games, commercials, and stuff. And again, I'm very happy that I had that experience, because I figured out that I was part of a big propaganda machine, doing some really horrible things, making demons. You know, the last project I worked on was Resident Evil 5, the video game, and a bunch of stuff like that, making demons come to life, you know, with sound and blood and guts and all that stuff. And one day I'm sitting there and I hear an interview on the radio, because, you know, we're in a windowless studio and I'm right on Hollywood Boulevard, the top company there, what used to be Sound Deluxe, it's now bought and sold. And I hear this interview, which I wrote about, on this guy who was, he was a soldier. And he would go in every day on the military base somewhere, I think in New Mexico, and he'd get into essentially a video game booth. And that was what I was doing most, was video games. And getting into a video game booth, grabbing the controls and basically flying a drone with a three-second delay in Pakistan and Afghanistan and everywhere else we're illegally occupying. And, you know, dropping bombs, and he says, it's mostly women and children that you kill. Occasionally you'll hit an actual target, but the accuracy rate was like 5 or 2% of their targets were actually who they were targeting. The rest was collateral damage. So here's a guy literally going to work every day, killing families that are completely, you know, in their own country, in their own place, their own home, going home to his wife and child every day like it was just a 9-to-5 job. And that was my crisis of conscience. That was my last straw, if you will. It was the time that I said, okay, there is no job out there for me, because something is desperately wrong with everything right now. And I have to know what it is. And that's the point where I became basically a full-time activist. I haven't worked a real job since. Basically became a monk and have been researching, writing, making movies with my limited, you know, video skills and audio skills ever since. And Yeah, that's what brought me to today. I wish I could give you some exciting story about my life since then, but it's basically been in dictionaries, the Bible, and you know, as many books online and sources that I can find. And that's been my very unexciting, uneventful life since. So that's, you know, everybody has the story or their wake up call. Mine just happened to be a little more intimate and a little more self responsible, I think, creating a bunch of propaganda that essentially drives kids to have no empathy and no concept of what they're doing as quote unquote, you know, soldiers who fly drones and kill people. And that's just, I really realized the power of technology, the power of video, especially imagery, which is, yeah, we'll talk about that.
I'm glad you brought that up as far as how powerful imagery is, because oftentimes I bring up how the mainstream media can control people subconsciously because of the stuff they put in these films, and they know they've calculated certain algorithms, numbers, lights, everything else, and the psychology, and incorporate all that to get certain reactions out of people to obviously sell more films, create more product, and sell more product, push agendas, etc. I know that the Department of Defense has many agencies that will fund Hollywood films and offer certain resources as long as they change the script a little bit and push certain agendas. So,
and I witnessed that firsthand. My, you know, we'd have the great secret about Hollywood. It's not so secret. I mean, it's really easy to verify, is that you either are part of the bloodline of the people who run it, or you're not. And these very beautiful people go to Hollywood thinking that they're going to become an actress or an actor, and they always end up in a bar or a restaurant waiting tables. When you ask them what they do, they're an actor. But truly, they don't have the connections to get the kind of power that lies behind being a public figure like that. You find that it's just one big family, is what I'm trying to say. And you find that extends out to politics and the CEOs of corporations. And truly, that's what my book is actually very much about, is this sort of family that runs everything. Which sounds like a conspiracy theory and all of that, until you actually realize even what the word conspiracy means, which is not what you think. Everything will sound kind of crazy until you actually say, oh, okay, it's a lot more simple, than what you think. And so I'm kind of here to take the mystery out of the concept of conspiracy, because a conspiracy is nothing more and nothing less than a plan between two or more people to do harm to another. I mean, that's a pretty simple, I mean, that means that you, I mean, technically that a conspiracy is, I mean, you're born in conspiracy. You're everything is a conspiracy and under those terms. And so you kind of have to see things for what they are in reality, and then realize, well, that means that government is actually the conspiracy, a plan between two or more people to protect themselves and do harm to others or to injure others, which just means to bring into law. And so that's where we're actually at. And the reason people can't do anything, the reason people can't seem to prove conspiracies or get anything done about this conspiracy and that conspiracy, is because they're going to the conspirators, which is government, to try to prove that the conspirators are conspiring. And you think about that, and it's actually pretty foolish, because of course, if something is born in a combination, a confederation is another word for conspiracy, if that helps. Confederation and conspiracy are actually the same words, a plan between two or more people to injure, which again means to bring into law, injure. And you're like, well, of course there's no judge in their right mind that are going to pronounce a conspiracy. The only conspiracy that a judge will see is one against government, not against the common people. Right, so we've got the wrong idea about just about everything because we have the wrong interpretation and knowledge base when it comes to language and words. So
they definitely have that play on words, and I'm glad you brought that up. Now, could you tell our audience, Clint, about working with these organizations where you're creating demons? And let me just say real quick, I think of oftentimes these video games, the graphics are just so intense that it's got to have an impact on your subconscious mind as well as your conscious mind, because I've done enough research into psychology where if somebody sees somebody get in a car accident, certain parts of their mind activate as the same parts that activate in the person that's actually in that accident. So, I can definitely see how they can control things. Now, when you say you were inside, did you see, like, agency guys come in and work out scripts? I mean, MKUltra kind of stuff. Talk to us about this. What was a 9-to-5 day like for you?
One of the things you kind of learn about this whole system is that it's almost the entire theme of this story that I'm trying to tell about the law is that it's designed to steal all of our property, our ideas, our intellectual property. Everything is designed to basically take that away from us and then give us in return for us putting it into the public domain. And if something is public, it means it's owned by government. So the idea is to steal people's property, to steal ideas, to have this big suction of information that, so that none of us actually own anything of our own, including the lands and the properties and everything, your car, you know, anything that's registered. Your children are also, of course, abandoned to the state, in a fictional way. Which is the concept of the birth certificate and all of that. So what you would see are people like me. I was very talented. I don't say that lightly. I was got a hell of a resume. I was sought after by, you know, these big companies out there, Capcom and, you know, I'm trying to think of their names now. EA Games and all these, they would, you know, they would handpick their teams. And, you know, you get good at something that you're passionate about. I was always passionate about being a perfectionist and making everything, you know, pop out in the sound. What I would find, and of course, everything that I made, I was working for a company that product was given to the company that hired us, and I have no stake in it. I have nothing. Hours a day in my windowless studio, pumping away, ruining my eardrums, and I have nothing to show for it. And what would I have to show but fiction, right? Nothing. Absolutely. I can say, hey, you can watch that. That's my work. And ultimately, what I'm pointing you to doesn't exist in nature. I haven't done anything. I haven't grown food. I haven't built anything. I've created a bunch of fiction that's designed to brainwash people. So essentially what happens is you've got script writers, you've got actors, and the voice actors in Hollywood are actually the most talented actors, I think, out there. They're the ones that can't get on the screen, mostly because they don't have the right connections, be it blood connections or, you know, other. And, you know, these guys would come in, the way it works is you do something called ADR, which is automatic, so how long I've been out of the business. Voice, dialogue replacement, automated dialogue replacement, where okay. The actor comes in and basically restates his lines looking at his own lips on screen. And that's why it sounds so good in the theater, because you're able to actually isolate the voice from the background noise, turn it up, and you want every aspect of it separate. And so essentially, these script writers would come in, especially for the video games, and they'd cringe every time they'd hear something, because in order to get your game or your book or whatever published, you gotta agree to the changes that they're gonna make. And so you'd have these, I'd worked on games like SOCOM and, the war games, I can't even think of their names right now. The director and the writer of the script would be in the room while we're recording these voice actors. And the actor would say something like, you know, good thing Homeland Security was there to save us. And, you know, the guy would just cringe because that was one of the added lines, right? One of the things that makes you say, oh, thank God government was there. You know, thank God government, or some symbology, you know, Masonic symbology that gets stuck in there, all that stuff. And so these guys, you know, one thing you learn is that you have to sell your soul. I don't care what profession you're in. You're an employee. You're an agent of some principle. And you have to sell not only yourself, but your intellectual property. You're basically giving it away in exchange for money or mammon. Money, of course, having no value. So you're really getting nothing for everything, your own property. And so that's the way it works. It's not so deliberate as it is sort of, well, we'll make this change and this change and this change. If you don't like it, then we'll scrap the project, you know, that kind of thing. There certainly are military games that are fully funded. And what I found when I started first doing research, I looked into government accounting, all their investments, which is what the Corporation Nation is all about. It shows you everything government is invested in. And it basically turns out that government owns every corporation out there through stock investment. So you're looking at Marvel, and you're looking at DC Comics, and you're looking at all these different ABC, NBC, Universal. I'll tell you, man, don't be fooled by the notion of independence when it comes to these companies, because the way it works is that, you know, he who has the majority share stock, especially if you have over 50% of the stock in a company, we all kind of vaguely, vulgarly know that that means you have control of the company, and you basically tell the company what to do. With government, though, through all their collective investments, and you find this in the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, which is literally the audit of every government, including the Federal Reserve. That's a whole other subject. You find all of their actual investments. Now, most of these investments are in debt instruments. For instance, if I have a loan, the California CAFR says there's over a billion dollars in just financial aid loans. Well, that's $1 trillion that you can actually say, well, I have a financial instrument, and though I don't have anything right now, I have a promise to pay. And so I can actually valuate that and use it as collateral for other things. And so it's called, you know, hypothecation. And that's kind of how government works. You know, it invests in just about everything you can think of, including, you know, all the foreign corporations in the world. People don't realize that China was built with American, with taxpayer, essentially money, with American money, or to the tune of like $10 trillion invested just in, just to build up China's corporations. Most of those corporations are owned by government, collectively 250,000 governments in the United States, all of them by law required to invest in pension funds and everything else, certain types of investments. And so what you find is that collectively government is the collective shareholder proxy and therefore proxy shareholder voter when it comes time to vote for mergers and acquisitions, who the board of directors are going to be, that kind of thing. So if you think about it, that spells fascism. That spells government owns corporations, and because government is the public shareholder, they pool all their shares, all these individual governments, and they do this what's called collective proxy shareholder voting, which, of course, that means that government is actually electing, because they're the shareholders, that government is the one electing the boards of directors for most corporations. The board of directors then is who elects the CEO. And this is what my entire, you know, the first 4 years or so of activism was geared towards, was showing this. I made a 4-hour documentary and a 2.5 hour documentary, you know, The Corporation Nation, that shows all these investments. And there's no way you can, there's no, there's no getting around it. It's right there in front of your face. You can pull up the CAFR, the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, or Annual Financial Report, for every government, including the Federal Reserve, and you can see exactly what's happening. I mean, the Federal Reserve audit, or CAFR, is 530 pages or so. And it tells you everything you want to know. All those things they say that the Fed doesn't tell you or you can't find out, it's all in the CAFR. And so you're talking about the golden secret of government, which is their actual financial report. The difference between this and the budget report that everybody's familiar with is that they don't show all these investments. All the investments are kept sort of, you know, out of public circulation. And every time a politician either discovers or mentions the CAFR, he's usually gone the next year. It's the golden goose, man. It's the great secret that if everybody could just stop and say, wait a minute, government owns all corporations, including the media, but it does so sort of clandestinely through stock ownership. And then of course all this proxy shareholder voting, suddenly the whole system, you know, at that point for me is when the system actually made sense. All these foreign investments, all these things that are happening. Well, yeah, it's government investments. And people complain to say that's taxpayer money, that's our money. It's not your money. It's not your government. It's not your system. You're an agent to it. It's not your creation. It's their money. The money you have in your pocket can be taken at any time. And guess what? I don't know why people don't remember the great gold confiscation of whatever it was, early 1900s.
Right.
But, you know, for everybody who's saying, hey, get gold, your gold can be just as easily confiscated as it was. In fact, probably easier than it was back then. The problem is you're participating in the property of someone else. Money is always the property of the nation that prints it. It's copyrighted under the nation. So the fact that you have it in your wallet does not make it your own. It means that you're in use of something that belongs to another. And truthfully, that actually explains taxation, because the only people that pay tax are people who use the property of another. Thus, when you pay property tax, you're paying that tax because you don't own, or you don't have the right of disposal. You're not a landholder or actual property holder. You're doing so through, well, the title of the book is Straw Man. You're doing it through the person of the United States, a vessel, a commercial vessel. And the law is all attached, and all the taxation is attached to the person. And until we understand that, and until we separate ourselves from that, then we're all bound to this whole system of law, this whole tyrannical system. We're bound to support everything that that government does, and we have no right to tort, we have no right to common law, we have no right to anything, because we are in the midst of basically, the easiest way to look at it is that your person, your straw man, is like renting a car. It's a vessel that you use for commercial purposes in order to use the patented property, letters, patent, and language of government, that corporation nation. And you know, what happens when you rent a car? When you rent a vessel, you have to follow not only the rules of the rental company. You don't get to make the contract; they do. And of course, you have to follow the laws, the law of the road as well, which of course is the government law. And so, the great mistake is that you are allowed to define your own terms. You are not, because you're in a contract with basically a corporation that rents you a vessel. My vessel is named Clint Richardson, right? And I use that for commercial purposes. It has a social security number. It has a bank account. It has a signature. And I use all of those things. And by using those things, I am now under the contract law, the public law of that person, that status that is assigned to me. And that, in a nutshell, is what the book is about. But the most important part, man, is that theft of property. The whole system is to give away the ending of the first book, is something called cheating, or escheat. To escheat something is to basically take the property of another. And that's the whole system is designed so that we're all walking around without any land, without any, if you will, sovereignty over our own land, any kingship over our own land. So we're always on the land of another. That's why it's called public persons and public, public lands. We're always constantly, we're basically refugees. We have no land of ourselves. Now we can mortgage, we can engage in a dead pledge, which is a mortgage, but we don't actually own anything that we're engaged in because we're doing so through government property. That's what the person is. That's the status. Can't do anything. Can't spend government money or get credit without having a person of government that is allowed to do it. So there's no way to talk about this in sound bites. I highly recommend people just download my book. It's free. I do it for free. I do everything I do is free because I don't know how to say this, but it is imperative that people read this, not because it's my opinion, not because it's something that, I want people to buy or purchase or anything. Like, no, none of this is my information. None of this is me trying to tell you to do anything. This is what the law is. Despite my opinion, despite my, what I want it to be or what you want it to be, you have to understand this system of law is a patented, letters patent thing that does not belong to me. I don't get to define its terms. I don't get to tell a judge what I am or what I, if I'm operating in their person, then they tell me what words mean and they tell me therefore what the law is. And until we realize that, until we come off of our sort of egotistic trips, and realize that in fact we're not that, mythical free people that we think we are, but in fact for lack of a better term, we're subjects or slaves to a landholding people, which we call we the people. Until we realize that, nothing's going to change. The matrix, if you will, is just going to keep getting stronger and stronger. And if you think about it, what is the matrix? You know, when you think about something I cover in my second book, which isn't out yet, but if people actually knew the origin of the movie, The Matrix, they would look at the movie itself as child's play. It's ridiculous. It's a horrible, horrible plagiarization of something very real, which is this sort of belief system that we have in the legal language, in the word terms, word magic, terms of art, that sort of thing. Boy, if people were to read the three books that the movie The Matrix is based on, they would absolutely disrespect the movie and realize that this thing is very real. One of those books is called Simulacrum and Simulation by Jean Baudrillard, a French guy that's dead now, unfortunately. But it's a prop in the movie. And boy, if you can understand that, if you can get through that book, that essay, and understand what this guy was saying, and you can see the blatant plagiarization without credit that was taken from that book, which is very much a reality on how we worship symbols and imagery and idolatry and all these things, you find out that the movie itself was actually just sort of a childish science fiction movie that gave you a false sense of knowledge or a false sense of understanding, when the true meat of the movie was actually these three books that it's based on. The other book was Out of Control, and then a book on psychology that I can't think of the actual title, but that'll actually be covered in my second book, which again will be free. So
how do you survive financially?
Well, I have very good friends. I do get donations. I've learned to be without. I mean, I will every once in a while I'll go to a thrift store and buy clothes. It was a lifestyle choice I chose to make. Like I said, my computer broke down at some point when I was doing my radio show, and I I said, hey, I need a computer to make movies. I need a decent one to, you know, to do this. And you know what, man? Some guy, two people stepped up and said, you know, I'll fund you. And they sent me, sent me cash, in the mail, actually. And that allowed me to buy a really decent, computer and be able to get back into making movies and doing radio and, of course, writing this book. So, I mean, when I've ever been in need, there's always been someone out there that will step up and send, you know, something in the mail. It's just always, I guess you could call it having faith, man. It's just always worked out. I've done a couple odd jobs too, worked what they, you know, some call it under the table. I call it a private contract, but, you know, that kind of thing. So you do what you can. And the thing about it is, man, I don't expect anybody out there to be able to do what I've done. Not because I'm smart, not because I'm more intelligent than anybody else, but because I actually allowed myself, I did what the Bible said. I allowed myself to have that's my main focus is knowledge. And that's all I do now is try to acquire as much knowledge. I'll have sleepless nights because my mind goes, you know, 20,000 ways, miles a second. And, I don't know. I'm trying to put this, everything I've learned down into, like I said, this sort of 3-volume work that I've been working on. And trying to survive basically, while doing so. And it's been very tough, but eventually, man, I got to tell you, when you start going without, you don't want things. You don't want the distractions. You don't want the movies. You don't want to go out on the town. You know, when you put yourself towards something, and you make the ultimate sacrifice. You sacrifice your career. You sacrifice everything to know what the truth is. And the truth is something that is so far different than most people can possibly imagine, because there's only one truth, and that's self-evident truth, which is another word for nature, or if you will, God. There's only one truth. Everything else is just fiction. Like I said, I spent 5-6 years learning about money, learning about financial instruments, learning about the stock market, learning about government financial reports. And in the end, what have I learned? Just kind of like my job, I was creating fiction or trying to figure out the best way to make fiction seem real. And then I'm going into government and I'm like, okay, I'm spending all my time trying to figure out the money system. And then you realize it's not real. Most of our employments, most of the jobs that we do are to, if you think about it, are to support the money system. Bank tellers and computer programmers and everything is, you know, all of our jobs now, the majority of them anyway, are to support a fiction, an artificial structure, a matrix, if you will, so that we have no pride in what we're doing. We have no land. We're sold the concept of living in tiny houses, for God's sake, which is basically the same as the Chinese people being put into, you know, little stack'em and pack'em apartments. But but your tiny house is on the back of a trailer and therefore you're free. Well, what that really is driving you away from the land so that you have no foundation in nature anymore. Your whole life is a virtual reality. And that is what simulacrum and simulation is about. That's really what the concept of the matrix, again, is plagiarized from. The sense of the real sense of worshiping symbols without actually acknowledging the reality they represent. The cross that is worn by so-called Christians is a perfect example of that. There was no cross in the Bible. Okay, the word afterlife is not in the Bible. And that's not something I'm just saying to be controversial. I'm saying, look, folks, the Bible isn't about afterlife. It's about this life, right? It's the law. It's not religion. It's actually the natural law.
Can I jump in real quick, Clint?
Yeah.
Do you think that the Old Testament is the natural law?
No, not... Now, the things that I tell you in this, like I said, in these sound bites, cannot possibly be quantified or qualified unless you, again, unless you read what I've actually put into this book. When you look at the Old Testament, why the New Testament seems to people to be sort of against the Old Testament, controversial, sorry. First of all, the entire Bible is figurative. All the words in it come from the Greek, the Latin, the Chaldean. To read it in English is to not read it at all. You can't get anything out of the Bible to read it in English.
You made a English good point right there.
What's that?
Said you made a very good point.
Yeah, well, you got to realize that the powers that be, what the priest's class used to do was read the Bible in Latin. Latin was always considered a dead language, and so all the people that were listening, and they still do it in Catholic churches, they're reading the Bible in Latin. They say, don't take Latin. Latin's a dead language. And yet all of our entire system of words is based on the Latin and the Greek, right? The Hebrew. So unless you go back and understand those terms that were originally used in the Bible, you can't understand anything about the Bible. The church has a very important role to play. The church has two purposes that have to be, that are self-evident once you realize it, to create believers and non-believers. Okay. The Bible says, hey, the Bible's very much against the church and the state. So don't ever affiliate yourself with anything but God, nature. The church essentially creates believers in its own doctrine, or it creates non-believers in all doctrines, including the Bible. So the very important part that the church plays, especially in reading the Bible in a language that none of the peasant class, who can't read in the first place, will never understand, is to never actually allow people to read the Bible. Again, if you're reading the Bible in English, you cannot get anything from the Bible. So what do? They create what Mark Twain called a mongrel language, a bunch of words taken from the Greek, the Latin, and superimposed into a language that actually is quite illiterate. So using language, I don't care if you're a PhD in the English language, you're just at the top of upper butt crack of illiteracy. You know nothing, because you must know the old languages, the quote-unquote dead languages that it turns out aren't dead at all. They're kept in the secret societies, or i.e. the society of the secret, their own secret. So the church creates believers in its own doctrine, which means that they are not believers, and believers means to believe means to be in love with, by the way. They're not in love with the Bible. They're in love with the church. And the church is against the Bible. Likewise, you have all the non-believers who see through, you know, that top percent, as Aldous Huxley said, of people who can't be hypnotized. You have all these people who are very much opposed to religion, quote unquote, and yet the Bible, it has nothing to do with religion. It is not religion. Religion is something that is created as a corporation, a church. The Bible is the law. It's the natural law. It has nothing to do with joining anything. It says, and I'll explain that a little further. So now you have two groups of people. You have believers and non-believers, lovers and non-lovers. These people, they love the church, but they hate the Bible because they're not doing anything that has anything to do with the Bible, but they call themselves by the flattering title of Christian. Bible says never take a flattering title, never have a person. The non-believers now hate the church, and because they think the Bible has anything to do with the church, they hate the Bible. So they don't ever spend the time actually reading what the Bible has to say. And how could they? They only know English. They've been taught since birth to be public-minded, to go to a public school, to be public instead of private, which is what I'm attempting to be, which is, hey, I'm going to pick up this Bible. I'm going to go through and I'm going to look up every word and what it actually meant back then. So what I discovered is that if we're really going to get to the bottom of the Old Testament, go to the source, go to the beginning. What happened? What actually happened in the beginning? Well, it says that the gods, plural, the Elohim, created the heavens and the earth. But what it really says in a language that is no longer viable because it's English, because it's a dead language and we don't understand and we don't bother to check what it actually says, you find out that there's words missing in that first statement. It says that the gods created the entity of the heavens and the entity of the earth, which again, these words have very different meanings than just, oh, look, it's heaven and oh, look, it's earth. God created the world, or the gods created the world. What does the New Testament say? New Testament says, don't be part of the world. Well, where was the world created? Well, you know, the gods created the world. And so the question that you have to ask yourself is not, what is God or who is God? The correct question is always when it comes to the law and when it comes to language and when it comes to the Bible, especially, the correct question is only ever, what does the word God mean? Now, when you approach the Bible and you ask that to every word that you see, you read an entirely different book, because you find that when the colonists, for instance, came over to America, they still referred to the king as God. Their natural rights came from God because they were citizens, basically subjects of what is called a god. The word God is a very generic term. It doesn't mean anything until you apply it and have sort of an, you know, you put a compound to the word. You actually define what you mean when you say God. So in the first part of the Bible, you see Elohim. You don't see Jehovah, which is actually let me backtrack here. Let's first define what God is. Problem is you can't, because the king used the word God. And when we look up the word God, we find that it was a translation for many, many different words. Theos was one. Archon was one. Gods, magistrates, kings, mayors, presidents, all of these are gods. So the church will teach people that in all instances when the word God is used, that's God. That's Jehovah. That's the essence of everything that we think of in the spiritual capacity of God. But in fact, all those times when God's wrath and God did this and God did that, that was actually referring to some king, some man who held the position, the legal title of, or ecclesiastical title, like Pope or King of God. You see, you can go back just 40, 50 years into the transcripts of court cases, and you can find that when you go to court in America and every other country, you're not pleading, you're praying to God. When you ask a judge, when you plead your case to the judge, another word for judge is God. And they openly used to say that in court cases. You pray, which today we say plead, to God, which today we say magistrate, judge, all kinds of different things. So at that point, you have to say, whoa, wait a minute. This Bible is completely different. So what it really says is that in the beginning, the gods, the kings, the magistrates, created a legal fiction. And then Caesar, the Bible says, Caesar came along and says, all you people must be taxed. Well, okay. What does taxed mean? Can you just say, okay, well, so we're all taxed. Well, what that actually means is registered. It says our property and our name must be registered. That's what it meant when Caesar Augustus in whatever chapter it is in the New Testament, when Caesar Augustus announced that all men should be taxed. Well, that means all men should, and men means male or female, child, whatever, all persons, all men should become persons, registered names and titles. Their titles should be registered and therefore their property taxed. So you have God coming in and creating a fictional realm, or what the Bible calls the world. When the Bible uses the term the world, it means everything that is not of nature. So the New Testament is trying to tell you to follow the personification or the story of the law. And this is where it gets real interesting. The word son, as translated, doesn't mean what you think it does. If it did, then Jesus Christ would be like everybody's son. It's weird. You know, he's the son of Joseph. He's the son of David. He's the son of Abraham. He's the son of this. Likewise, you know, you'd think that it's a zombie apocalypse because Lazarus raised from the dead. Hundreds of people were risen from the dead. Jesus was risen from the dead. But remember, this is all figurative. And we find that the word death is not referring to physical death. It's referring to what's called spiritual death. When I become a citizen of any nation, when I become a legal person or straw man, then I'm spiritually dead, but I'm civilly alive. I'm pretending to be a legal entity. That is what's referred to in the Bible as spiritual death. The concept of being reborn then comes into play. And, you know, it sounds like a religious term that really pisses most people off. I know it did me. For the longest time, I despised the church, and so I despised the Bible. Then I read the Bible, and I went back and I defined terms, and I found out that death is a very common legal or figurative term, metaphoric term, that doesn't refer to your physical death. It refers to your spirit, or your soul, if you will, to where you're spiritually dead. You can't live under the legal law in civil life, quote-unquote, fictional life, and also be under the natural law, which is the law of nature. It's an impossibility. One is mammon, one is God or Jehovah. You can't be both. And that's what, you know, amazingly, what I came to find is that all the Bible really is the worship of nature, or all of existence, the permanent existence of everything, as a verb. Not as a noun, not as an empty name, but as the actual existence. And you can verify this yourself. Just look up Jehovah in Webster's 1828 dictionary, or look up Jehovah in the concordances of the Bible, and you find out that it just means everything that is in existence, all of life, the universe, everything as oneness. You know, I am that I am, that kind of thing. And you find that God, When it's used to as Jehovah, no J, of course, was in existence. Yehovah, however you want to say it, doesn't matter. It's just a word. You must understand the notion or the concept, not just the word, because words are empty. All that permanence of being, you're worshiping it as the one true God, or, if you will, oneness. Creation is another term for that. And so I'm like, holy crap, the Bible is about worshiping all of creation as one thing, one God that we call Jehovah. And again, that's not my opinion. I want you to understand that is what the concordance is. That is what the Bible says. That's what the dictionaries define it as. And Christ, then, the notion of Christ, the word son, the word word, and the word, law, sorry. So word, law, and son turn out to mean all the same thing. So the word of God, or the word of nature, in other words, is the law of God, or the law of nature, which is the personified son of God, or the son of nature. It's not that we should be worshiping Christ as a God, it's that we should become Christ-like. We, in order to be in tune with nature, we have to find and follow nature's law. And so I said the word cross is not in the Bible. The word cross actually translates to storos or pika, which is a pike or a stake. All right. Now, every word has a figurative and a literal meaning. So we know what a tent stake is, right? We put it in the ground. That's not the kind of stake. That's not the kind of stake it's talking about. You have a stake. I have a stake. Everybody out there listening has a stake. It's called our driver's license, our property rights, our laws, our legal everything. That's our stake. And so what it's saying is pick up your stake in everything that is fictional and follow the Son, which is the word or the law. So personification is again, going back to the notion of the straw man. Straw man comes from straminius homo, which is a Latin term. It means a man of straw, one of no substance, put forward as bail or surety. Okay. And that's exactly what we are. We're surety for the property of government, which is called a person or a status. Persons don't exist in nature. So we are to pull up our stake out of the fiction or out of the world that was created by the false gods, the magistrates, the kings, and we're to follow the Son or the Word, the law of nature, of God. And that's the whole, I mean, that's the story of natural law. You know, you can call it anything you want, but it always goes back to the Bible. Now, the Bible's not an original document. It's a copy of a copy of a copy. It's the ancient wisdom, ancient knowledge, and that's okay. That's not an excuse not to learn and not to go to the Bible to get that ancient knowledge and to really truly understand that the word self-evident and the word self-existence are the two words that best describe what God is, because it's all of nature. Now, I can look at you through this screen, man, and I can say, you know, I can see an image of you, but that's not what I'm seeing of you, and what people are seeing of me is not self-evident. The only way we can have self-evident existence or truth together is to actually be in each other's company, to be able to experience each other with our senses. Everything else is nonsense. This, what you're seeing is actually a coded language that is being processed very quickly. It's very impressive and it's very amazing. It's technology. Woo! But what technology just means art. Art is never reality. So you're seeing a language. That little camera is taking my picture. It's coding it into a language because that's all it can do. A bunch of numbers, a bunch of symbols, kind of like that Matrix thing going down. And it's rebroadcasting it as a picture that looks, talks, feels just like it's me, but it's not reality. And what we've been trained to do is to respect the image, the art, over the reality. You're seeing a symbol of me, but you're not seeing me in reality. So when we say the words like reality, what we're really saying is God. And I found that to be probably the most greatest spiritual awakening that I have ever come across, was simply to ask, well, in the Bible and in law, what does the word God mean? Not what or who or where, but what does the word mean? And until we start asking that question about every word that we hear, well, then we're stuck in what they call dog Latin. Dog Latin is the grammatical set of the English language. They call it dog Latin because when you're referring to a slave, you're referring to a beast, a four-footed beast. And so they call men who are enslaved as four-footed beasts. That's animals, essentially. The word animal, again, very important word. The word anima means soul. Anima, you put an L on it, or an A-L. A-L takes away that which comes before it. So if I'm animal, I'm soulless. My soul has been eaten. And that's exactly what civil life or personhood, citizenship, membership in a church, all these different personages is. It's spiritual death. It makes us into animals. And we've all heard that animals have no soul, which is absolutely patently ridiculous. But in law, we're not talking about the real thing, we're talking about metaphorically. And so if I'm considered as an animal in law, someone that's not regenerate, someone that's not following the natural law, then I'm animal, I'm a four-footed beast. Like, I speak dog Latin, I'm human capital management. That's how it works. So I know, I'm sorry to rant, but again, to talk about this in sound bites is virtually impossible, because we have to literally, before we do anything else, we have to learn the language that enslaves us. Right now, we're only reading things in a language designed to keep us illiterate, to keep us from never understanding anything in the legal system, in the Bible, in anything that's important for us to know. Because, you know, they say a Bible-reading people can't be enslaved. Well, that's a true statement, but we don't read the Bible because we're reading it in English. Very, very controversial, very, you know, very verifiable. I'm only giving you the information that I have found that has nothing to do with me, my ego, anything. It's not my opinion. This is how it all folds together, the systems of law. And one final thing on that is that the Bible is part of the common law. And this is very important, because it's the very foundation of all other law, all comes down to that first origin of law, which is nature, God's law, the natural law. From there, everything changes. Everything goes into a different place. The maxims, the principles of law start changing to include contractual relationships and all these different relationships that take you out of your natural self. And so a citizenship of the United States has no natural rights, has no unalienable rights, because, again, you're renting a vessel, a rental car, a person from government. When you're operating in the property of another, you have no rights except that which are given to you through that franchise. You know, and it's funny, because every word leads to a new word. What does freedom mean? It means franchise. People don't want to know this. People don't want to contemplate this, but the word free in the legal sense means franchise. A McDonald's is a franchise of the mother corporation, but it's independent, right? It can operate out here alone, but it's still part, a vessel of the mother corporation, even though we call it independent. Independence is a word that is completely misunderstood. All these words, because they're only known in English and no one takes the time to truly delve into the meanings of these words, we use them all incorrectly, and therefore our intent, our will, our desire to communicate is always opposite to what we intend. That's the purpose of language. That's the purpose of word magic. The magic spelling is to get us to never be able to communicate our actual will, so that every word we use legally is quite opposite to what we intend or what we wish to communicate. So the judge is hearing Latin, you're speaking English. You're speaking English, but the judge is like, well, ha, you just said something that got you, you know, put you into under my control because you don't know the meaning of your words. I'm only hearing the Latin meaning. You're only here speaking the completely illiterate dog Latin English version of the word. right? So that's what the book, that's what this whole entire, my whole existence has been figuring this out, putting the story of the legal law, which has never been told, next to the story of the Bible, which is all we have. We don't have the cipher, the dictionary, the meaning of the words in the Bible. Likewise, we have the dictionaries, we have the meaning of the words in the law, but the story of the legal person has never been told like it has in the Bible. So you have the natural man and the legal person. And if you put those two stories, the Bible or the scriptural law, the moral law, the unwritten or unenforceable law, next to the legal law, which is the strict law, the Roman law, and you watch those two entities walk together, you see that everything the legal person does is quite opposite and opposed to what the natural law says that we should be doing. In other words, everything we do is against the Bible. And that's very important.
This has been great, Clint. I mean, you have so much knowledge. Please, when you apologized a moment ago, I was like, no, this is great. You're in the zone. Keep going. Because, you know, really, we could talk probably once a week with the different terms and interpretations of words, breaking it down to Latin, dog Latin, not being the right way to use English when you're talking to a law, speaking with the law, I guess you could call it, under the land. Now, the straw man book that you put together and the fact that it's free, that's amazing. You could easily charge $20 for it on Amazon. You let it out there for free. I think that's wonderful. And certainly I'd like to have you back on the show again sometime. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely, man. I appreciate the time. And like you said, it's free. The worst thing that can happen is it sits on your sits on your computer and does nothing. I am asking people for donations just so I can actually get it printed, because my greatest fear right now is that all of this, we talked about this, all of this information that's on the cloud and out there can disappear tomorrow. It can disappear off of your computer, my computer. It can be gone in an instant if that is the desire of these controllers of this internet. And I really learned the value of old books that are very difficult to find, even though they're on the computer now. It scares me to death to think that this, 10 or so years that I've spent putting this together could disappear tomorrow, literally, and be lost. The information that is not my information, it's just an explanation of the ancient knowledge put into a concise form, that could be lost again, that all of my efforts are gone. And I'm asking for donations just simply to print and get the book. Because, I mean, let's face it, man, people like us, we can't get ahead. I can't do what I'm doing and also get ahead. I can't offer things for free to people and also get ahead in any way. It's impossible. And so my one desire at this point is to actually get this in a printed form, keep it private, and be able to get it out there, even to give away the books for free if people, want to. The only way I can do that is to print enough books to where the price goes down to where you can actually give some away for free and that kind of thing. So the worst feeling in the world is to be stuck because money is the obstacle. Then nothing could feel or be worse now that I understand the notion of how money controls us, not that we control it, So that's where I'm at. I wish nothing more than to print this book. And I always wonder all these million and billionaires out there, how long they think this is going to last, right? Without supporting people like us out here. So I don't know, but I do thank you very much, man, for letting me rant.
Oh man, it was great. I'm certainly glad you gave us your testimony and just what amazing opportunities you have brought yourself to now because of what you left behind. You could be sitting in a cush office right now, doing the eating caviar, lobster tails, enjoying the finer things, I guess you could say, in corporate plastic life, or do what you're doing and giving everything out there for free. You quit that. You're in a much more nature-oriented type place now, and you're probably feeling a lot better because of it. Now, one other thing I want to ask you before we close out tonight, just real quick, give us the websites to get access to the book and your other two websites, then we'll close out. Thank you.
You know, I looked real hard, and I did a lot of research because I wanted to keep this all private. And so I found out that the only real website you can get that's quote unquote not commercial is .info. So strawmanstory.info is where you can just download the free book. Look, I don't want anything. I don't expect anything. It's a charitable gift. It's my entire life's work. Take it and run, that's fine, or donate to the cause, that's fine too, but I expect nothing. So strawmanstory.info, download it, print it so that it survives. I mean, I'm dead serious when I say that. My blog is at realityblogger1g.wordpress.com. And, my documentaries that I made, including, one that everybody should see, which is called Lethal Injection, which is the story of vaccination, basically, is on thecorporationnation.com, and it's thecorporationnation.com. So my radio shows, I did 2 years of radio on RBN, Republic Broadcasting, plus all my other interviews since are also I put that website at the end of my book, actually, and it's corporationnationradioarchives.wordpress.com. Big long title, but you can sort of hear my journey for 480 radio shows, getting to this point of understanding. So
right on. Well, thanks so much, Clint. I can't wait to speak with you again. You have a wonderful day. And, folks, make sure to go to leakproject.com. If you become a contributing member, you'll have access to exclusive content. Also, youtube.com/clandestinetimelord. If you subscribe on YouTube, you'll get access to the latest podcast for free. Also, make sure to be the change you want to see. Have a wonderful day. This is Rex Bear. Talk to you soon.
Take care, my friend.
Take care. Hey.